Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the Acura TL with Bluetooth phone connectivity. Learn more at Acura.com.
Back now with Day to Day. You know, 20 years ago, America's Most Wanted first hit TV screens and the armchair vigilante was born. Today, you can be an armchair vigilante and fight crime online. Tony Ganser of member station KJZZ has the story of how a shop owner in Mesa, Arizona, turned to YouTube.
The Big Stick cigar shop in Mesa is pretty cut and dried. A news program plays on a flat-screen TV bolted to the wood-paneled walls. There's a pool table and glass cases full of lighters and expensive watches. Owner Bob Gerton built the place himself from the ground up.
My cigar lounge is a smoking environment that you can come in and shoot a game of pool, play some cards, some dominoes, chess, checkers.
It wasn't the checkers that gave Big Sticks headlines last month, though. Gerton's shop has a high-quality video system which clearly recorded the faces of a shoplifter and his accomplice. The thief can be seen looking up, searching for a camera on the ceiling before clumsily grabbing two expensive Seiko watches. After filing a police report, Gerton began handing out flyers with suspect pictures on them and moved to put the surveillance tape on the video sharing site YouTube in hopes of
making him famous, embarrassing him, maybe even getting him to turn himself in, which didn't happen.
Gerton offered a $1,000 reward to encourage tips about the theft. Since posted, the shoplifter video has been viewed more than 30,000 times. Police caught the thief late last month after the watches were spotted in a pawn shop down the street from Big Sticks. It's not clear what effect YouTube had in the case being solved, but Gerton's video highlights a new form of cyber vigilantism.
I do think that there is a trend of seeking a form of distributed justice.
John Palfrey is executive director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. He says the internet has made web users part of a distributed justice system where many users act as judge and jury, in cyberspace anyway.
It provides an avenue to get more information about who might have done this thing and a higher chance, in their view, of bringing that person to justice.
Palfrey says there is enormous power in being able to spread information over the internet, but there is a problem. If someone is falsely accused or defamed, there needs to be due process.
I think we have to remember that checks and balances are needed in a law enforcement system and make sure that those are built into any widespread deployment of distributed justice.
Even without checks and balances, the handful of crime videos that have made it to YouTube seem to be popular online, though their popularity may be related to their novelty. Steve Corman is a communications professor at Arizona State University.
If it really got to be a popular thing where there were thousands and thousands of these videos out there, it's a little hard to imagine people sitting there all day looking at crime clips on YouTube.
Corman says people get a kick out of watching criminals in action, and without the novelty, the videos may lose their effectiveness. It seems for now users are still interested. A man in New Zealand recently posted a video about his stolen laptop, which was viewed more than 500,000 times. For now, shop owner Bob Gerton is still interested in posting his surveillance tapes online, and he says he'll definitely post videos again.
Don't wrong me. I will get you.
For NPR News, I'm Tony Ganser in Phoenix.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Tomorrow might be the beginning of your wireless future. The FCC is beginning to auction off a big chunk of the wireless spectrum. It's likely to be the last time that any significant piece of the airwaves will be available for cell phones and computers. And the FCC says a large portion of it must be open. That means for the first time, you could buy a phone from Verizon and keep it when you switch to, say, an AT&T plan. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
That cell phone may be just the beginning. Imagine this. At the supermarket, you can't remember if you're out of milk. You whip out your phone to call your fridge. You are out of milk and eggs. Your alarm clock goes off. It connects to the internet and gives you a personalized traffic report for your commute.
There are delays on your usual route down Highway 4. Better use I-126 for the next...
10 years ago, you'd read these articles about refrigerators that called for milk and, you know, things like that. And they haven't really materialized. And I think one of the reasons is that there's excessive control of the airwaves.
Columbia Law School professor Tim Wu. The wireless airwaves have been controlled by large providers like AT&T and Sprint. Now they have a say in everything that gets connected to their networks. Jason DeWitt is an entrepreneur who founded Vindigo, a company that develops applications for mobile phones. He says when you have to get your invention approved first by a big company, it dampens the entrepreneurial spirit.
Frankly, I wouldn't try and launch a wireless refrigerator, but if you were crazy enough to try that yourself, you can be certain that Verizon and AT&T and others would be extremely reluctant to spend the money required to test that equipment.
DeWitt and Wu are hoping that tomorrow's auction is going to change the process. The FCC is requiring whoever wins some of the most coveted wireless spectrum to open it up to any device. That means you wouldn't have to get Verizon to approve your fridge before you sell it. Despite the FCC's requirement, Tim Wu has concerns that if one of the big players, like Verizon or AT&T, wins the auction, they will find ways to keep that milk-scanning fridge off the market. Verizon recently announced it would open its networks, but it still says independently developed devices must go through a trial before it hooks them up.
Trials can either be a routine inspection to make sure the product is safe, or a trial can be something that lasts for 5 years and a product never gets out of.
None of the companies planning on participating in the auction would comment for this story because the FCC requires a quiet period before the bidding. But major wireless carriers have said they object to open networks because a badly designed refrigerator could take down the cell phone network when you ask it if you're out of milk. But the bidding will be fierce because it is high-quality spectrum. It's a bit like Superman's X-ray vision. It can go through walls and mountains.
It just makes signals go further, go clearer. It's what people call beachfront property.
Gigi San, director of the consumer advocacy group Public Knowledge. Google is expected to bid on the spectrum. Google is interested because it wants to, say, put its own ad for milk on your wireless refrigerator without having to go through Verizon. But San says Verizon or AT&T will bid high because they can't afford to lose their market dominance.
They will spend above market rate in order to keep this valuable spectrum out of competitors' hands.
The auction itself could take weeks or even months, and the spectrum won't be available for use until 2009. So it's likely to be a while before you see that wireless alarm clock or refrigerator. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
So imagine, if you will, a sale the size of a football field. Now, imagine that sail hundreds of feet in the air, kind of like a parachute. Now, imagine the giant sail pulling a huge cargo ship in the middle of the sea. Can you picture it? Well, this is really happening, and it's happening today. It's called giant sail technology, and it was developed by a German company called SkySails. It's the first cargo vessel equipped with this kind of giant sail, and it's called the MS Beluga, and it sets off from Bremerhaven, Germany today on its maiden voyage to Venezuela. Turn wind into profit. That's the company's motto. And if this journey goes as planned, the ship will use 30 to 35% less fuel, saving about 4,000 tons of oil a year. Adam Weiss from the current Science and Technology Department at the Boston Museum of Science is on the phone to help explain to me how this is going to work. Hey, Adam.
Hi, Rachel.
Thanks for being here. First, I've got to tell you, I've got this really kind of bizarre picture in my head of what this thing looks like. Something between the sails of yesteryear, you know, Nina Pinta Santa Maria, something like that, and a kite surfing parachute pulling this big cargo ship. Can you set me straight on what this looks like and how it works?
Well, your idea is right in that it's kind of a hybrid of those two things, but it looks a lot more like the kite surfing parachute. It looks like a parafoil, the ones that are kind of wing-shaped, and it flies out in front between, you know, 300 and 1,000 feet in the air. And in the case of this particular ship, it's about the size of a tennis court, although future ones are going to be football field size.
Oh.
So it's like a giant parachute out in front of the ship pulling it.
And how is it controlled? Are there people out there, you know, like tacking and doing what you do when you sail, or is it automated?
It's completely automated, actually. They don't need any extra crew members from a normal cargo vessel to run this. The crew does need 2 or 3 days of training to figure out how the system works, but it's all computer controlled. There's an autopilot system built into it, and you can literally push the auto button and sail away.
Wow. So explain to us why this is supposed to be so efficient.
Well, I mean, it's efficient because you're using the wind to pull the ship. Normally, ships are using their propellers, and propellers really vary in efficiency. So this technology is adding power directly to the ship. It actually attaches to the same part of the ship that a tugboat attaches to, and it pulls it just like a tugboat. It doesn't provide, you know, the full power for the ship.
There are engines. There's something else helping it along, right?
Yeah, you need the engines. As you said, it could offset through the course of a trip between 10 and 35% of the, you know, of the energy the ship needs. But if the wind is blowing in the right direction under the right conditions, it could actually offset 50% of the fuel needs of the ship during that time.
So how expensive is this technology?
The technology's not terribly expensive to install when you think about what ships cost. This system cost about $725,000 to install, and a system for a large ship. I mean, this ship is big, but it's 430 feet long. If we talk about a 900 to 1,000-foot cruise ship, that system would cost more like $3 or $4 million to install. But on a big ship, it would save $1 million a year in fuel, so it pays for itself pretty quickly.
And the technology is scalable? You can apply this to situations where the ship would be so much bigger?
Yeah, actually, this kite that they have attached to the first ship is a smaller version. It's about the size of a tennis court, as I said. They're actually going to replace this kite with a larger one, about the size of a basketball court, roughly twice the size of this one, in the near future. And then there are a couple of more ships that are being constructed right now that'll have that basketball court-sized kite. But they're also working on kites that are much bigger, and they hope by 2010 to have something the size of a cruise ship, 900 to 1,000 feet long, that could use one of these kites that would potentially be almost as big as a football field.
So what's the future of this technology? You're talking about cruise ships. I mean, is this really the future? Going to be seeing, you know, Princess Line Caribbean tours with big kites on the back of them?
Well, that's certainly what the SkySails company hopes for. They're looking at having 1,500 ships or so equipped with this technology by 2015, and they say that it's applicable to almost all of the ships that are out there on the sea. And they have plans to use with something even as large as an oil tanker. So, yeah, cruise ships, cargo vessels, even smaller vessels like buoy tenders, they're thinking could use this technology. But it's really only for the parts of the trip that are out in the open ocean. They're not going to use it right by the shore.
Now, I have to say, so this technology and this company, these are German endeavors. And Germany has a huge amount of wind industry, people thinking about wind, people creating new ways to use wind energy in Germany. And this boat is taking this German technology, this wind alternative energy, on a boat to Venezuela, one of the world's largest oil exporters. Is this just random coincidence? I mean, I imagine they had some say in what was going to be the first journey that this technology would be employed on. Is there anything to say about that?
I'm not actually sure what the background of the trip to Venezuela was. I know that they are really pushing that connection to wind, though. In the promotional materials for SkySails, all of their computer-generated images of this ship and everything that they've shown show the ship actually carrying wind turbine parts for large wind generators. So they are pushing that connection, but I'm not really sure why they're going to that oil-producing country.
Interesting. Maybe Venezuela inquiring about wind energy. You might see that happening. Well, Adam Weiss from the Current Science and Technology Department at the Boston Museum of Science, thanks for explaining to us.
Thanks for having me on, Rachel.
Big sails. So coming up next, the story of a wolf named Romeo. Some call him the lone wolf of Juno and his epic battle with a pug. That is drama you will only find on the BPP blog. And you will only hear about next on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Natural disasters are one thing. After an earthquake, you get new building codes. Hurricanes, evacuation planning. When a disaster takes a century to unfold, like rising sea levels, getting people to focus is a lot harder. That's a problem many low-lying countries face. For our series Climate Connections with National Geographic, NPR's Joe Palco went to Holland. And in the face of the enormous but slow-moving threat, the Dutch government, at least, is rethinking its thousand-year strategy of keeping all the water out.
To understand the history of the Dutch battle against water, a great person to track down is Geert Mak. He's a writer by trade, but he's one of these guys who think deeply about topics, and he's thought a lot about the Dutch relationship with water.
You see everywhere here ditches and small old canals.
Mak is every bit the urban intellectual, but he also maintains a rural hideaway in Friesland in the north of Holland. That's where I caught up with him. The ditches and canals are not just scenery. They're a critical part of the man-made drainage system that keeps this soggy country from filling up like a bathtub. Mak points out the window of his modern farmhouse at the flat field stretching off to the horizon.
This is the pancake country. But when you look well, you see a very small, hills. They call it terpen.
When the Romans were here 2,000 years ago, they figured out that making a bit of high ground to build your house on would keep you dry when the floodwaters came in. Beating back the ocean, draining lakes, and turning them into farmland, Mak says the Dutch have always worked aggressively to protect themselves from high water. And yet now, Mak says something puzzling is happening in the Netherlands. People seem to believe that only poor low-lying countries like Bangladesh are going to be affected by the sea level rise that will come with global warming.
I'm amazed all the time, because we are a very rich Bangladesh, we are a very modern Bangladesh, but we are a kind of Bangladesh, and we are one of the first victims of the climate changes.
It's as if the Dutch have tuned out the threat of climate change.
This whole problem with water, with weather, with storms, with climate change, they have the idea it is far away, while it is really, it is at their door, they're sleeping.
There was a time some 50 years ago when the Dutch were equally oblivious to their peril. Leave Friesland and head south to a town like Willemstad, not far from the North Sea, and people will tell you about the night of January 31st, 1953, a night when a horrific storm awoke people to the danger at their door.
It was a weekend evening, and a full moon, very strong winds from the northwest, high tides.
That's Jerry Meyerman. He was 9 years old on that stormy evening. He was living in Willemstad. He and his father were walking home from a friend's house late that night. They walked to the top of the dike. His father looked at his watch, looked at the level of the water.
And he said, you know, when that tide comes in, it's going to come over the dike.
If that happened, the town would be lost. Jerry and his dad went to wake up the mayor, who woke up the city council for an emergency meeting.
We sat in this room with the local notables, who simply decided that this could not happen because it had not happened before. So they would not ring the church bell. They would not wake people up.
An hour or so later, the icy water did come over the dike. The dike collapsed, and the water came thundering in. The next morning, Jerry went out with the search parties to look for survivors.
And we found my best friend and his family, and basically were alerted by his dog, who recognized me and came running over. And we found his body. He was also 9 years old.
The flood damage was widespread. 2,000 people died. 72,000 homes damaged or destroyed. As is typical with natural disasters, people demanded immediate action. The government responded. It launched an overhaul of its North Sea defenses. Engineers designed new storm surge barriers, new dams, and giant steel floodgates. The North Sea would never break through their defenses again.
We are here at the Maaslands Barrier in Hoek of Holland.
Jos Kuipers is with the Dutch Water Ministry. Maasland Barrier is the final piece of that overhaul launched 50 years ago. It's a massive floodgate not far from where the Maas River meets the North Sea.
You can compare it with two gigantic doors, one on the north side of the river and one on the south side on the river.
When a storm causes the North Sea to rise, the doors will swing shut.
And then they close off the whole river and keep high tides out.
Kuiper says this will protect Rotterdam and all the small, low-lying towns nearby. And it's easy to believe him. Standing below this giant steel structure, you get the feeling that it could withstand almost anything nature could throw at it. Even people who lived through the flood of 53 can feel safe now. But that's a problem.
Most people in the Netherlands rarely think about the fact that they're living below sea level or in a sensitive area.
Eric Boezenkool is with the Water Ministry's planning office in The Hague. He says the dams and barriers that were built after the 53 flood might be adequate if it were still 1953, but today there's something more insidious to worry about, which he describes in six words, give or take.
climate change.
If the Dutch people have tuned out the problem of climate change, the Dutch government has not. And for an American journalist like me, it's, well, unusual to hear a government official more worried about climate change than the general public.
One of the issues which we have to deal with in the coming years is to have a create some type of sense of urgency, but we don't want to stir panic.
But how do you do that? Buzenkool isn't sure, but he says doing it is essential because the government is changing its strategy for dealing with water, and it's a change that will make people uncomfortable. After 1,000 years of trying to keep the water back, now the strategy is to let the water in. That's the thinking behind a project called Room for the River.
We are on the farm of Mr. Jacques Broekmans near the Meuse River.
René Persens is standing next to the Broekmans Dairy Barn. He's an official with the local municipal government. His job is to help Mr. Broekmans to relocate, because this farm is on one of the 40 parcels of land the government has designated as flood zones for the Meuse and Rhine rivers. Is Mr. Broekmans happy? No. But Persens says he will move.
Sometimes we don't agree about the price we have to pay for their farms, but eventually we will make a deal, I'm sure of that.
Because Persens believes, and the Dutch government believes, even Mr. Broekmans now believes that the safety of the country depends on it. Gerrit Mak says this idea of letting the water go where it wants is going to take some getting used to.
The Dutch are used to tame the nature, always to win. But now they have to accept retreat and to give parts of the country back to the water because it is better, because it is more clever.
And because climate change will force them to anyway. Joe Palca, NPR News.
We're going to talk now about an experiment in communications. It does not involve the FCC, but it does involve video cameras, the internet, and two brothers, John and Hank Green. They realized their relationship had become nothing more than a series of text messages and emails, so they decided to do something about it. That was just over a year ago on New Year's Day.
Starting on January 1st, today, I will send you a video blog. Tomorrow, you will reply to that video blog. We will continue like this until the year is up.
John and Hank called a moratorium on the written word and began posting their video communiques on YouTube. Gradually, other people started to watch too, tens of thousands of other people. John and Hank's experiment ended a couple of weeks ago, and they join me now. John from Indianapolis and Hank from Missoula, Montana.
Hi, how's it
going?
Good. This is John.
This is Hank. I just want to say that this was not my idea.
So, John, this was your idea.
Yeah, it was. I guess it was my idea, but then neither of us had ever edited a video in our lives. But on January 1st, Hank managed to make something, and on January 2nd, I managed to make something in response, and it just kept going for the rest of the year.
It should be mentioned that John actually had to call me on January 2nd and have me tutorialize him on how to use his computer.
How old are you guys?
I'm 27.
And I'm 30.
So you're of the email generation.
Yeah, yes. Very much so.
Okay, so you were worried about not having that human contact.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, text is a very empty form of communication. When you go from actual physical presence to spoken word and then another step removed to text, it becomes a much more shallow way of communicating.
Well, let's give people an idea of what we're talking about here. Let's play this vlog entry from last year. This is you, John.
Well, Hank, I've now gotten my hair cut. Do you like it? You like it? I like it. I'm pretty happy with it. I went to a barbershop in Washington, D.C. called Louie's, and the guy who cut my hair had cut the hair of both Bill Clinton and Willie Nelson. And when he told me this information, I was like, Bill Clinton and Willie Nelson are both historical figures whose work I admire, but I'm not necessarily looking to emulate their hairstyles.
At the risk of being mildly insulting, these aren't exactly deep thoughts that we're talking about here that you were sending to each other. I mean,
you're right that it isn't a deep thought, and we were never very sentimental in the videos. I don't think either of us ever said, I love you. In fact, just saying that we never said I love you just made me feel awkward.
It does. Yes, I agree.
Yeah. Oh, let's just forget that ever happened, Hank. You're a good man. But there is a kind of depth to it, because there's a familiarity. There's an intimacy that goes along with letting Hank know what I did today. And for many years in our relationship, there was no opportunity for us to go through the things that we did each day with each other. You know, so those little things do, I think, in the final analysis, really bring a kind of intimacy to a relationship.
I just spent 2 hours and 13 minutes downloading your 2-minute and 1-second video, which can mean only one thing, that I'm at Mom and Dad's house, the last residence in the United States of America with dial-up internet.
On the upside, it's awfully pretty.
Plus, I get to be surrounded by memories of our childhood.
Were you surprised by the number of people who began to follow your video relationship? Did it change the way you did it at all?
I can't speak for Hank, but I don't think it changed the way I did it very much. I feel like, in some ways, we always knew that there was an audience, even if it was just a few people. And when the audience got bigger, it was more people, but ultimately the most important person in the audience for me was always Hank.
Good morning, Hank. It's Friday, October 26th. Today I'm going to discuss the political situation in Nepal while eating 5 sheets of toilet paper.
So I think that's sort of in the spirit of the project, that Hank and I have things that we care a lot about, but we're also kind of goofy and nerdy.
Now, you talked a lot about a lot of big issues, microfinance, global warming. And you even arranged a charity fundraiser you called Project Awesome.
Well, we basically got many of the people who watch Brotherhood 2.0 to create their own video blogs featuring a charity that they really, really care about and that matters in their lives. So all these people got together and they made these videos about these charities. And then we used the power of our fans, which we call Nerdfighters, to go on YouTube and feature all of those videos by sort of fooling the YouTube algorithm into thinking that these videos were the most awesome videos for the day. And we pretty much did it. We took over the majority of YouTube for that day.
But this was mainly an experiment in how to be brothers over the internet. What did you learn?
Well, I think the biggest thing we learned was that it's really fun to have a sibling and know them as an adult. You know, I left home when I was 15 to go to boarding school. And so the last time I lived full time with Hank, he was 12. And this was our first real opportunity to become grown-up siblings.
Do you miss it now that you're done?
Yeah. Hank, do you miss it?
I do. I was just thinking yesterday, I don't miss making the videos, but I miss receiving them.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same way. I don't miss listening to me, but I miss watching you.
Yeah.
That was too cheesy.
No, it's so cute.
It's too sentimental.
It was completely sincere, and you could tell.
It's true. It's true, but it's gross.
Thank you guys very much.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hank and John Green, they produced daily video blogs all of last year called Brotherhood 2.0. They joined me from KUFM in Missoula and WFYI in Indianapolis.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.
Good to see you again.
Hey, good to see you. Glad to see you got your Diet Coke to keep your caffeine going.
Yeah, excellent.
Two of the nation's top cybercrime enforcers interrupted their busy morning last week to sit down and talk to us about their jobs. One works for the Department of Justice, the other for the FBI. They investigate and prosecute cyber criminals. I don't want to be an alarmist here, but what are the odds that the average citizen is going to be the victim of a cybercrime?
I can tell you this. You put an unprotected computer on the internet, and I would say with virtual certainty within 30 minutes your computer is going to be compromised.
Scary stuff to start this week's segment in our cybercrime series. Today, we're going to examine cyber fraud. Since the beginnings of the internet some 25 years ago, hackers and other computer criminals have found ingenious ways to use this technology to their advantage. Kevin Mitnick was one of America's most wanted and now works as a cybersecurity consultant. We called him. He explained how he became a notorious hacker.
Well, because I had such a passion for technology and wanting to learn how technology works, I compromised numerous companies, namely telephone companies and companies that develop cell phones and operating systems. And at one point, I became a fugitive. And I used my computer skills to evade the government, the FBI and the U.S. Marshals for about 3 years. And finally, when they caught up with me, I became the example. I was arrested in a point of time where the Justice Department wanted to make computer crime a top priority, and they needed a symbol to show their dedication to fighting computer crime. So my case was used as that symbol.
Kevin Mitnick did nearly 5 years in prison for hacking into dozens of corporate computers, stealing proprietary software, and damaging their networks. Chris Painter helped put Mitnick behind bars when Painter was an assistant U.S. attorney in the mid-1990s. Today, he heads the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property section of the Department of Justice. He and his FBI counterpart met us at the Justice Department's offices here in Washington.
Good to see you. Yeah.
Good to see you.
We're seated in the cybercrime lab at the Department of Justice, a very clean, well-lit room. There's a horseshoe counter with various computers on it displaying the Department of Justice seal and several small computer towers called FRED, which is a forensic recovery evidence device. Chris Painter is jovial and low-key, yet eager to tell us some stories. So we ask how cybercriminals have evolved.
Cybercriminals are certainly very clever, and they certainly, because of their nature, their technical experience, have advanced and found new ways to commit crimes. I mean, we're always seeing new and different ways for these criminal groups to act. And frankly, we've seen a real change in the kind of paradigm of these cybercriminals. We had a lot of these criminals who were doing these hacking and other crimes, doing it somewhat for their own edification, just to show that they could. Now what we're seeing more and more is organized criminal groups, sort of like traditional OC groups, but they are spread all over the world and they're linked virtually by computers. And they're doing it now very explicitly for the money. This is where the money is. And because this is where the money is, that creates a greater threat. It creates a better motivation for them. And although the traditional people who were using the net just to commit these crimes were not all that bright in the way they committed them in the past, and the hackers were really smart in the way they did them, we've seen a convergence between those two groups so that they're doing it for money and they're being clever about hiding their identity, going through different countries.
Tell us about that. What are some of the new ways they're committing crimes?
Well, one of the things that we've seen really grow over these years is something called botnets. And botnets are armies of what are kind of colorfully described as zombie computers or slave computers that are tens of thousands strong that are operated by a control channel to do a whole host of different crimes. I think both of us have called these in the past the Swiss Army knife of computer hacking and computer crimes because they're used for identity theft, they're used for spam, and we've been targeting that, and the FBI specifically has also been targeting that.
Chris Painter is seated next to Sean Henry, Deputy Assistant Director of the FBI's Cyber Division. He's been leaning back in his chair listening to Painter, then he straightens up in front of the microphone. Henry is a little intimidating, a G-man in black. His head is shaved and his gunmetal gray eyes seem to have X-ray vision. I get the feeling he knows everything about me. I want to know more about these botnets. So Henry explained the FBI's strategy.
We actually started a botnet initiative. We termed it Bot Roast, a clever play on words. But just to focus our agents and our analysts on what the threat was. So two methods for us, I think, to try and have an impact on the problem. One is the deterrent effect. Being able to aggressively investigate and then through the Department of Justice successfully prosecute somebody and let them know that when they commit one of these crimes, they're going to pay for it. They're not going to get 6 months probation, but they may get 5 or 6 years in prison sitting next to somebody who's doing hard time for a physical crime. So actually being able to investigate it successfully and have a deterrent effect is one part. But the second part, I think, that is critical is to raise the public's awareness. When Chris talks about these 10,000 bot armies of computers, there's actually millions of computers that are controlled, and the average computer user does not even know their computer is under somebody else's control. So for your listeners to understand this, you might be working on your computer, surfing the internet, shopping, and there's somebody who is actually on that computer with you and you don't know it. You log off. They're actually using your computer to attack other computers, to steal other people's passwords and usernames, to steal people's credit cards, so that the resources of your computer, because it's not adequately protected, is susceptible to being utilized by somebody else.
Our lives, how we work, and how we communicate have been changed immeasurably by the Internet for the better. But you should know the risks. Even the savvy FBI investigator Sean Henry says he's amazed how sophisticated cybercriminals are.
In this environment, in this virtual world that we live in, we've seen these organized groups that live virtually, where we have groups that are organized, not like the Sopranos organized crime, but organized in that each of the players in this group have a specific expertise, and they may never have met each other ever. They meet online in a chat room, one from Turkey, one from Ukraine, one from the United States, one from Greece, one from Russia, one from you name the country, each of them having a specific particular area of expertise. One might actually compromise computers and develop a botnet. One might write spam emails specifically to entice you to give up your username and your password. Somebody might actually harvest those credit card numbers when they come in. Somebody else might actually take the money and physically launder it and turn it into real money. And then somebody else might actually send the money using Western Union or some other type of financial transfer mechanism to get the money into the pockets of the other members. They never meet. They never see each other. They never touch each other. But they are organized. They are together. And to me, that's an aha moment where we watch crime actually move from the physical world to the virtual world.
So how do you protect your computer? Here are some tips our experts gave us. Keep your firewall turned on. It's like a gatekeeper who checks all your visitors. Use antivirus software. Make sure your operating system is up to date. And when you're not using your computer, turn it off. If after all that you still become prey for the cyber fraudsters, you can report it to the federal authorities. Go to the website, ic3.gov, to file a complaint. There's more on our website, npr.org. No one is immune from cybercrime. Police officers, lawyers, and doctors have been defrauded. Susan Grant is the Director of Consumer Protection for the Consumer Federation of America.
You have to remember that con artists are really insightful. They know what buttons to push. They know what makes people tick.
Grant tells the story of one woman, an accountant, who was sucked into an email scam originating from Africa.
She was convinced that this person had contacted her about getting his money out of his country and into her bank account because of her accounting expertise. He also appealed to her because through their communications, he picked up on the fact that she was a very religious person. And so he started to say that he was as well. When this person contacted me, she had bought plane tickets to fly to Ghana to meet with this guy, and she was within 3 days of going.
Susan Grant is with the Consumer Federation of America. Next week, in the final installment of our series on cybercrime, we examine cyber stalking.
If somebody wants to stalk you, the internet is a huge advantage for them now. They don't have to put the work they used to have to put in to find out your address, your phone number, what you look like. So we've got a situation with immense amounts of information that are outside of your control, yet are probably accessible to people with malicious intent.